Hello and welcome to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Belinda Walia, and today's conversation is about the person behind the microphone, identity, ambition, resilience, and what life teaches us when things don't always go according to plan. My guest today has spent years entertaining audiences through radio, television, music, comedy, and live events. He's built a career around conversation and laughter, but behind every successful career are the chapters people don't always see, the risks, the setbacks, the pressure, the reinvention, and the experiences that change us along the way. As a British Asian man in the public eye, he has also witnessed enormous changes in conversations around culture, representation, immigration, masculinity, and what it means to belong in modern Britain. Tommy Sandu is a broadcaster, presenter, DJ, comedian, and entertainer, known for his infectious energy, humour, and ability to connect with audiences both on and off air. Tommy, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you to the show.
Oh, Belinda Walia, thank you so much. That was super lovely. I love that. I wanted to interrupt so many times in that. I'm going to go, and I was going to heckle it and comment on it. Is when you went, things don't always. And by the way, you've got a very calming voice. So I felt like I was in a sort of, you know, and rightly so, a psychiatrist chair with a doctor. And I feel like I'm kind of like, Tommy, lean, you know, things don't always go to plan, do they, Tommy? Tell us. And I feel like, no, flip it, never go to plan, Belinda. That's the problem. It's not sometimes. It's like, it's always,
All the time.
there's always a change of plan along the way. But go on. Yeah, thank you for having me. And that was very lovely. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. So, Tommy, relax your body.
Oh, here we
Just
go.
reply.
I need a tail. I need mustard oil. Translation.
Okay,
Mustard oil.
so translated, that means mustard oil. Yeah.
Which is the Indian oil of choice for everything, for relaxing, for making your hair grow, for I don't know, for muscle aches.
Everything.
Mate, I
Yeah.
tell you, saruda tail. There you go, mustard oil. Sorry, go on. You were going to say, I am relaxed.
Tommy.
I'm relaxed.
No, that's good. I'm just teasing you. So,
Okay.
Tommy, people know the broadcaster, they know the DJ and comedian, but who are you when the microphone is switched off?
Oh, I'm a mess. I'm a mess. I'm boring. I'm boring. I'm dull. I'm moody. It's hard. It's hard to answer that. I tell you what, the mic is on a lot of the time. In what I mean by that is, I think my life is a bit of a performance. I love people. I've always been outgoing and what's the word, like OTT, a bit extra on my energy. So I talk to everybody everywhere I go. I talk to everyone at the till. I talk to random cars that pull up next to me. My kids say it. My wife says it. They went like, what did my son say on the weekend? He goes, you don't have to talk to everyone, you know. And I'm like, yeah, I do. I do. I think they all need a little slice of me in their life. And my sister said that weirdly as well. She goes, why do you feel the need to talk to everyone? I'm like, yeah, you know, we're just here if someone's over there in the swimming pool at a hotel or something like that. So I do feel like I am how I am. And I remember once about 25 years ago when I was getting into TV, and it was the head of Channel 4, Richard Wolf was his name, actually. He's a really nice guy. And he said to me, he's one of the commissioners there, and he goes, you know what's good about you and what's good about presenters, he goes, you are the way you are off air and on air. He goes, actors are different, models can be different. Anyone who's a musician or a celebrity in a different way can be different. But presenters pretty much need to be the way they are in front of a mic and not in front of a mic. Because otherwise I think people will hear the disingenuous in you. But I'm quiet. If you ask, you know, when we got married, my wife said to me, what, you know, she goes, oh, like when we started living together and a bit more, she goes, you're quite quiet at home. I went, yeah. Well, like, not, she goes, you're not quiet, but she goes, you know, you're not what you are out there. I said, yeah, but that would be mad, wouldn't it? You know, nobody expects Beyonce to be twerking at home. She probably just makes a cheese toastie and goes to bed. You know, and I hear that from a lot of people. People, you know, other fellow comedians, Paul Chowdhury. Paul likes to keep himself to himself. A lot of comedians are quite low key. You know, they're quite off air. They're just literally quite quiet because
Yes, that's
it would be weird. It would be weird, you know, to be always always like that all the time. So yeah, I think like anyway, I think I'd like to think I'm a family man, and I just, you know, if I'm not working, I'm just with the kids, and now with our new dog. So we've got a dog and kids and cooking on and things like that. So yeah, just quite regular dad stuff, really.
Which is lovely. And I love that, Tommy, because what you're describing is authenticity. And there isn't really an on-air Tommy and an off-air Tommy. That ability to connect with people is so natural for you, which is great. But
Oh, thank you.
growing up, did you always imagine a life in entertainment, or did your career happen almost by
Yeah,
accident?
by accident. Yeah, I suppose. Okay, so my dad pushed, and I would say he pushed us, me and my sisters, into drama and performing arts. And the reason why he pushed us was because he was in the business world, and he sometimes saw, not really in himself, but saw amongst managers, an inability to communicate, an inability to speak to groups of people, a lack of confidence, a lack of physical awareness. And he actually, kind of ahead of his time, you know, you could think he came over to this country when he was 7, 8 years old, you know, very much an Indian boy. And actually, a neighbor of his took him for an audition, and he ran out the room crying, for when he was like 10 years old. And he reflects on that. And he said, you know, the neighbor thought, oh, he's a handsome little boy, let's get him to do that. And he goes, he remember he had to go into an audition and say the words, "Bow now, brown cow." But he couldn't say it because he'd literally been in the country a few weeks, and ran out the room crying. And he was out in the workplace where managers would just suddenly go all red and get flustered and have to stop the presentation. So he said, you've got to be able to speak, and you've got to be able to move, like physically dance, because it gives you a physical awareness of your body that will then kind of come across in business. And I think he's really right. And you know, you get taught that spatial awareness in drama. So my sisters, who are older than me, two older sisters, they did drama, performing arts, and all of that. So my point was that I was just, from joining school, I was just put into the school plays because my sisters were in the school plays. So they were like, oh, this is their little brother. He's coming through now, and he's gonna be just like them. So it was almost like bestowed upon me, like, there you go, you must be into drama. And I'm like, I guess I am. But I remember distinctly, I was about 8, 9 years old, and there was a it was Epping, in Epping. There was a motor company, and the sign said Le Epping Motor Company, but it was written in French, motor spelled MOTEUR, whatever, right? And it was Le, and I put on an accent. And I went, oh, it's Le Epping Motor Company. Huh? And I was like 8 years old. And my mum and dad laughed, and my sisters laughed. And I remember that distinctly, kind of going, oh, I like that. That was good. I did a little thing, and they laughed. And then the first character I played in a school play, about 6 years old, it was this money-obsessed man with a big hat and putting on the outfit and being up there. And I had a little catchphrase, which was money, money, money. Oh, I love money. My mum still says it to this day because she remembers it. And so acting, drama, performing was always there. And then I was a prefect. And then where you're doing drama in the school plays, you're the outgoing one. Where you're then the fat kid at school, and I was, you're using humor and the mask of confidence to kind of protect any vulnerability in your size or any mickey taking they might do of you. I was never good at football, never good at the obvious sports. I was really good at rounders because I could just smack the ball really far. But no one plays that anymore. That's an old reference. Kids are listening to this kind of going, what's rounders? So the acting thing, the you know, being in school plays, being a narrator. I was always given the narrator role in school plays. So I was never given the acting role. I was always the voiceover. And then I went and did work experience. You know, like when you have to do it at 14 years old, I rung the work experience agency, and she said, oh, you've got a really good voice. You should work for us and call companies to get more work experience positions for fellow students. So the voice thing always kind of got recognized weirdly, even though everybody, including myself, hate the sound of your own voice. You know, when you hear yourself back, you go, oh my God, is that what I sound like? Oh, I talk so fast, or I'm so blibbery, I'm a mess. But the voicing just happened, and then before you know it, that led to getting into DJing, getting into the, you know, and then I got the voiceover job on Blind Date, and you know, from being on that show. So I think performing and being out there was always there. And then I always think I felt different to other Asian guys at school because I was doing flamenco and performing arts when they were doing business and engineering or playing cricket or football. I just wasn't. I was secretly hiding the fact that I'm doing Spanish dancing. I never told anyone. I was like a, honestly, I was like a brown Billy Elliot. I think there's a whole spin-off story of Billy Elliot, which is based on my life. Bolly Elliot. I think Bolly Elliot could be a thing where he's Bollywood dancing. He's a little Desi boy, and he's trying to hide his dancing from his men, from his friends. But so I hid that and did dance, music, drama, and I think that has really helped me. Dance helps you know how to stand, how to walk, so you don't have an awkward shuffle, things like that. So weirdly, I think all my childhood was leading to a career in performing or entertainment. I just didn't know it at the time, but I think all the signs were there.
No, I love that. And I think it's really interesting because earlier on, your dad clearly understood very early that communication and confidence are skills that can shape every area of your life. And I love the fact that you're saying that you were a brown Billy Elliot, but underneath the humor, there's something really important there about feeling. You that feeling you had to hide a part of yourself to fit in, and yet the very difference ultimately became one of your strengths. So you've worked across radio, television, music, DJing, and comedy, and I'm already laughing. I've got a big smile on my face
Good.
at the moment.
Good.
When did you first think I've actually made it?
No, I honestly, I don't think you do, and I really don't think you do because a few things. I'm going to kind of. By the way, I have a scatterbrain of a head, so I'm going to jump around from topic to thing and all that. So, Cilla Black said many things. She was really good for these little one-line anecdotes and lessons in life. You know, this is a working-class girl from Liverpool who was the host of Blind Date, and obviously I worked on the show, but I got to hang out with her quite a lot. We spent probably one or even two nights a week where she would be filming and then we'd go for dinner, or she'd be out with other people and she'd go, just come along to me and my agent, and we'd go back to hers after a night out, 2 o'clock in the morning. We'd be there just chatting, and she would just be telling stories, and it was always her stories were like, oh, and then Joan Collins said this, and then along came John Lennon, and then along came Paul McCartney, and then, you know, it was all us. That's her world. So you learn from that level of entertainment. And one of the things she said is, this business is a tightrope. And she goes, the minute you start looking around at what others are doing or start to self-congratulate yourself, like, hey, check me out, aren't I doing amazing? She goes, you'll fall off the tightrope. She goes, don't look up, just focus on the next step. And people are going to say stuff, people are going to hurt you, people are going to bring you down or even big you up. Oh, God, you're amazing. That will throw you off as well because you'll start to believe your own hype. So I really I don't feel successful now. I feel like it's all been a process. A few years ago, I read the Will Smith book, Will, and he talks about building a brick wall and how his dad made a brick wall. And he said, you never set out to make a brick wall. You set out to just lay one brick and then lay the brick next to it. And I think that's what we've always done over the last nearly 30 years in this business, about 20, 25 years. Is you go for that audition, you do that voiceover, you do that connection, you shake that person's hand, you go for a meeting there, you try this, you send your show reel off there, you send your DJ mixtape off there, and you know, I feel like I've just been trying all my life. But you know, and then you sort of, if you do stop with moments like this, talking to yourself, or you know, not that I get many awards, but if you get an award, you kind of stop and reflect, or on a birthday, on a milestone, I'm turning 50 this year, you kind of reflect and you think, yeah, you know, we've had some the best of times. I mean, I think I've lived like an amazing life with the travel show, abseiling down Table Mountain in South Africa, shark diving, eating food in the best restaurants around the world, meeting the most famous people on the planet, from Will Smith to Johnny Depp to Shah Rukh Khan to Amitabh Bachchan and more. So that's really, you know, you take a moment, you go, yeah, that's quite cool. But right now we're just focused on the 10 other things you've got to do right now. And we're not stopping anytime soon. So I don't think I don't think I've ever felt successful. I think being at the BBC felt good. You know, because that was like, wow, you're at the BBC, you know. But then the pressure's on to what are you going to do tomorrow on the show? What are you going to do today on the show? You know, you've got a 4-hour show to film. There were many times you pull up at 5 a.m. to go on air at 6 a.m. and it's 5 o'clock in the morning. It's dark. It's November. It's a Wednesday. It's raining. and you look at the BBC revolving doors and you go, shit, I've got nothing to say. I've got nothing. I've got, I don't know what, I don't, there's nothing different from yesterday. I went home yesterday and I went to bed. So what am I doing today? But then the light goes on, the little red light in the studio to say you're on air. And the bakwas, the nonsense starts to flow. So I don't know what happens. It kicks in.
No, and thank you for sharing that. I love what you shared there. And I think staying grounded is really important because obviously as the audience, we see the success. But what has been one of the toughest chapters behind it?
I think without a doubt, the hardest thing I've probably been through in my life was losing my job at the BBC. And I try to take a sort of spiritual approach to it and kind of think, I know I did nothing wrong. Many other people know that as well. Not everyone will agree. People will always have an opinion. People say many things. And I think that was hard. I think, weirdly, if I can connect it to this, being the only son, being the boy in the family that then made everybody laugh, and then being the person on air that just made everybody laugh, and we got on well with everyone. There were never any complaints. There was no issue with my work. There was been no issue even around my conduct at the BBC even now. But through that association to be in that WhatsApp group, and then they assumed that it was a dark men's only group where we were doing, and I'm like, no, none of that's going on. This is all just, look at the messages. They're all nonsense. This is just silliness. And there were some, as we all know, there were some seriously dark things going on at the BBC. And I'm like, these guys are just idiots. You know, like in my group, my producers, they're just idiotic lads. And those lads exist everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's nothing sinister here. And that's that. But the problem was, in hindsight, I think the BBC wanted me to go, oh, I'm absolutely appalled at this language that I'm seeing in these messages. And I generally hadn't seen a lot of their messages because I just don't check group messages. I'm that guy, by the way. Should I tell you right now? I tell you in live time, there you go. People get anxiety off the back of this. I'm that guy that currently has how many messages unread? Look at this. Let's go to 637 text messages and 1,542 emails. So I'm that guy who doesn't always get back to people. And I'm like, if they need me, they'll come back to me. And I've told the boys when we worked on the radio show, I said, oh, you know, if ever you want me, I don't check those group messages. Just message me directly. They all knew that. But of course, people are people. I wouldn't just say lads are lads or boys will be boys. People will be people. And in private and their WhatsApps, they will say silly, outrageous things to be silly and outrageous. But when you're in front of a BBC tribunal and you're going through the code of conduct and what language is appropriate and not appropriate, their language wasn't appropriate. And I get it. They lost their jobs. They did that. But I didn't say anything like that. So the injustice of what happened, because they literally had no bad words that I'd said or anything, or even I'd liked or hearted. But they said, but why did I condone those messages? I said, I don't go around condoning or not condoning anyone. I just don't believe you should do that. I think each of their own. And I think in my faith and Sikhi and our spirituality, it's more about you. It's more inward. You're more reflective on how I am as a person. Make sure that I treat you with respect and love and support and warmth. I'll still take the piss. I'll still take the mick. But we will, you know, it was more like, I know my intentions. I know my heart. And I know I've never done anything bad to anyone or even said anything inappropriate to anyone in any context, WhatsApp or a face-to-face or otherwise. Yeah. So the hardest thing about that period was the injustice, the bit that I got stuck on for years. And I mean, I had therapy, I've spoken about this before, but you know, many therapists, two different therapists, was to say, like, I just can't get it out of my head. I used to wake up thinking about it, go to bed thinking about it, brushing my teeth thinking about it, and kind of going, what did I do wrong? That's why am I here? And then you sort of question yourself and you go, maybe I'm so up my own backside that I don't even realize that I'm actually a real deviant, terrible person. And I'm like, no, but I don't feel any kind of way about people of other races or colours or anything. I don't feel any other kind of way about women in the workplace, you know, or anything. Or, and I'm not flirtatious with other women. I make a big point of not being that way because I've got two sisters, because you know how to conduct yourself, because you've been raised in a certain way. So it was the injustice. That was definitely the hardest thing. And still is, I ain't going to lie. I would love to be able to sit here and say, 8 years on after being sacked, wherever it's been, 9 years, eight, nine years even, that, oh yeah, you know, that, you know, it was a blessing in disguise and things happen for a reason. No, it was terrible. It made me really sad for a really long time. And then you realise that going through that makes you just stronger. It's like, and I say that to everyone now, it's always the toughest times that make you stronger. So you go to the gym, you rip your muscles by doing lots of weights, that makes you stronger. Training, running further makes you stronger. Going through rubbish times, losing people that you love makes you stronger. And I think that was definitely the hardest time of my life.
And thank you for sharing that. And I really appreciate it. And I think that's such an important truth to acknowledge. Not every painful experience has to be reframed as a blessing as well. Yeah. Sometimes something was simply deeply unfair and deeply painful. And the resilience can be in continuing to move forward while still being honest about the impact it had on you. So, Tommy, thank you. I think what's already coming through is that behind the laughter and entertainment, there are so many experiences that shape who we become, particularly the moments the audience never gets to see. We're going to take a short commercial break now for a word from our sponsors. Stay with us. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Belinda Walia, and today I'm joined by the broadcaster, presenter, DJ, comedian, and incredible entertainer, Tommy Sandu. Welcome back, Tommy.
You are too kind, I tell you. And honestly, I feel like people are going to listen to this kind of going, he ain't that good. Belinda, you're like, oh, he's incredible, and he's this, and he's that, and, you know, and oh, how do you define your success? And I think I could just, and I imagine the cynics just listening to this kind of going, what success? Like, hello, he was on Asian radio for a few years and did a voiceover on ITV. That's it. You know, that's all we know him for. But I had this chat with my dad, my dad was kind of going, like, you know, you're always chasing something. You know, you've been like that for 30 years. And I remember saying, like, yeah, I feel like I'm never really there. I've never really got there. And he goes, yeah, maybe you're just, you know, you're going to be spend your lifetime being a wannabe. And he goes, no. And he said things in the past. He goes, oh, you know, he goes, you're like a 6 out of 10. I said, a what? I went, what? And he was deadly serious. And I went, I said, a 6. And he looked at me because he realized he'd got a reaction. And he went, oh, no, like, you know, like a good solid 6. I went, a solid? I said, I'm your only son. You rate me at 60%. Of potential son. Like I said, that's a B minus, dad. Like I'm a B, what? And so, but that's how on it, that's what keeps you grounded. You got parents, you got a dad like that, and my sisters as well. Yeah.
Oh, it's lovely. And I love that because there's so much humor in everything that you do and say, and even in the family environment. So you spent much of your life making people laugh, but has humor ever been your way of getting through difficult times?
Yes. Yeah, I can't emphasize it enough. That's why I stumbled. Yeah. Like, humor for me is everything. It's an escape. Like, not only like going on stage tonight, I'm gonna do a show. Tez Ilyas, the comedian who's in Man Like Mabeen, and he's a brilliant comedian, Pakistani comedian, roots from Blackburn. And Tez is doing a show, so I'm gonna be supporting him, and I can't wait. But what I've realized is, you know, even when I'm go around the country, I'm going off to a gig, you know, just getting on that train or getting in that car, putting on my music, knowing I'm gonna go and do that, it's the best feeling in the world. And to the extent that the problem I've got right now, and it literally, this is a live conversation happening in my house at the moment, which is my wife and everyone else saying, what are you going to do for your 50th, which is at the end of November this year? Oh. And I went, I don't know. Like, what, you start thinking about, what am I? What do I want to do? And I said, my connection to this is, I laugh all year round. I literally hang out with professional comedians who are hilarious, or people that are in the entertainment business, or dancers, or musicians, or singers, or famous people who have come over from India, and concerts and things like that. I get to go on stage at Wembley. I've just been booked for, you know, the O2 next year for Shreya Ghoshal's event. The O2 is celebrating 20 years, and Shreya Ghoshal is their Bollywood representation, I suppose, on a whole big lineup of 20 years of the O2. And I get to be there, and I'm the host for 17,000 people. That's brilliant. I love that. So, you know, having a laugh all along the way, I think, is also part of the brand. It's what people like. When I went through my dark times with the BBC, I did a kind of a heavier podcast about men's mental health, and I wanted to talk about it because I thought, oh, I know how it was for me. And I found a lot of the conversations to be quite cliche and a bit, not patronizing, I suppose, but a little bit, just a bit formulaic. Like, so how does that make you feel? And when you feel like this, this is what happens. And I'm like, no, I don't know what it is. I think we're just sort of deep down pissed off and annoyed when you're down. And for men, a lot of anxiety and stuff is linked to money and things like that, and feeling successful, feeling respected. And I had, in that moment, had lost my identity. I'd lost my respect because I was suddenly tarred and feathered as this wrong'un. And I felt like I'd lost the audience. I lost the connection I made. I lost my entire career I'd built for 20 years. So all of that fed into it. So you have to look at the lighter side of life. You have to use humor to go, you know what, don't take it all so seriously. It doesn't really matter. And people don't really care. And the things that you think really matter and you get caught up with, I just think in the bigger scheme of things, don't. And I don't want to get all cheesy here, but I think what matters is sort of, like, without sounding corny, like love, and just loving people and treating people nicely, treating being there for your wife and kids and your mum and your dad and your and any random strangers or friends that you can be there for. That's it. That is literally it. Everything else is just feels like quite superficial. I've had, you know, everything from like the big houses and all of that kind of stuff and the lifestyle, and you can have the cars, but I just find all that a bit empty. So coming back to the 50th, I'm like, oh, I don't know what to do. Eat in nice restaurants, I do that literally all year round. Go holidaying, I do that all year round. Go to a concert, go to a gig, my life is pretty joyful. And this is why you got to take a moment and go, actually, it's all right. Everything's all right. So just carry on.
Yeah.
So just carry on.
Every day is the birthday.
I say that, Diamond, because we joke about that, and we kind of go, you know, there's no such thing as Valentine's Day and birthdays. And so the birthday becomes a bit of a gesture. And I think I do it more for the kids, so that my boys can kind of go, oh, you know, we know we did this for Dad's birthday, we cut his cake. If I suddenly go, oh no, I'm beyond partying, I'm too big time, and I don't need anything, and I'm just going to rather go off on my own, that's too weird. So I think I will have to do something normal, but deep down I'm like, no, you know what, I'm all right. And like I said, so my whole point, sorry, you asked the question, is humor playing a part in my life. I pretty much have a laugh wherever I go. It's lovely. And the amount of times you get people coming to comedy nights, I've got to say it, particularly Asian women of a certain age. When I mean of a certain age, like probably married, over 40, who just for some reason life has taken over, kids, money, pressure, work, running the house, trying to be the old school Indian woman in typical senses and being the new school one as well, which is a working, earning, independent mum, but yet somehow reflective of the values of yesteryear, because that's what's still somehow needed for certain women of certain. I mean, the 25-year-old girls, they don't do that. The youngsters are a different breed. But I see these kind of 40 to 55, even 60-year-old women, they'll come to the show and they'll go, oh my God, I needed that. They don't say, oh, that was a great night. Oh yeah, they're laughing that. They go, I don't remember. I've heard it 30 times a year. I hear it. People saying, I don't remember when I laughed like that. And then you go, oh man, you got to do that more often. Or you get people saying, I've never been in a theater before. Wow, it's my first time in a theater. And they're like 50, 60 years old. But because they're of an Asian background, it's just not really on their cultural radar. And I'm not knocking them for that, but I'm like, oh my God, live music, anything live in a theater, it's like a drug. It's so uplifting. So, you know, why haven't you done that? So, you know, that live, that experience, that comedy, and I not only love it and need it, but I want to almost inject into others as well, and hopefully give them a little pick me up along the way, you know?
And that's incredibly powerful. I love that, because laughter can become something we forget we're allowed to experience when life becomes consumed by responsibility. And to hear somebody say they haven't laughed like that in years really shows the impact you're having. So you're not just entertaining people, you're giving them a little piece of themselves back. But how much has being British Asian shaped your identity and the choices you've made?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've always, I've always felt different. And having two older sisters meant I was emotionally open. And what that meant was that, you know, anything that went on in the house, we would talk about. You know, I remember saying to my sister once, because I've got a very good looking cousin who's light skinned and he's got green eyes and he looks a bit Mediterranean and he had wavy hair and girls used to come from other colleges just to see this hot guy. And he was 2 months older than me. So we were raised side by side. And there I am, this fat, chubby kid who didn't get any attention from girls or anything like that, literally walking to and from school every day for however many years with this super, super hot model-esque cousin of mine. And I said, you know, I said to my sister when I was about 12, I said, everybody just wants to know him. You know, when we go into a room, I can feel it. And she said, well, you walk into that room and everyone will want to know him. But by the time they leave that room, you make sure they know you. And that stuck. That just, many things my sister said and my mum said stuck. Little things like that, they frame you along the way. So coming back to your question about being British and Asian, the values that come down through our mum and dad, and then our siblings, and then our network, because obviously we're one of, my dad's one of seven siblings. So my four aunts and my three uncles, two other uncles as well as my dad, all of them have kids, and all of those kids live nearby. They still do to this day. They're all in East London. And then all of them go on and get married. And then all of them have kids. So there's like about 200, 300, you know, close family members within about a 4 mile radius of where I am right now. So it's never quiet. That noise of family is always around whenever we're together. Particularly when we were younger, when everyone was a lot closer, that kind of working class immigrant family all meeting up in a house, pots of food everywhere, you know, an aunt playing the dolki, a little drum, and, you know, everyone else just chatting away. You either are heard or you are, you know, eaten alive by banter and all the rest of your friends and family who are in that room. So that perks you up. So your British Asianness, your understanding of the dolki and bhangra, as well as hip-hop and R&B, your reflection, you know, of the world. I remember going into classrooms at school and they said, oh, what did you eat for dinner last night? And I lied because I thought, I'm not saying I had roti and dal and sabji and whatever else. I've got to say I had pizza, you know, something else. And then it was a science lesson. They were talking about the nutrients of it. But, you know, you fast forward now, I think probably 80% of the kids will probably have a curry, you know, and even like some non-Asian ones. So, you know, it was a very different time. I've always thought, as I've got older, anybody great, anything great, or anything, anyone who's achieved anything, they're not like anyone else. Madonna is not like anyone else. Michael Jackson is not like anyone else. Michael Jordan, Mike Tyson, I can't think of, I'm thinking of all Mikes, I don't know why Mike's coming, but like Shah Rukh Khan, Amitabh Bachchan, they're not, you wouldn't go, yeah, Amitabh Bachchan's great, but he's a lot like, I don't know, Faroz Khan. No, he's not. He's Amitabh, he's this, he's that. So I think, coming back to your identity is key. And I want to say this to everyone who, when they people say, oh, they want to get into presenting or whatever, I said, you got to be you. You got to find your voice, what you're about, and let your words flow authentically. Because otherwise, you'll always sound like you're trying to be someone else. And I see it so much, sadly, on social media with these youngsters. And they're trying so hard. They're like, oh, my days, I'm here and I'm talking like this. We're coming out to this and da-da. And I'm like, I know that's an inflection. You know, you learn a lot from the different ways in which people interact. So then it tunes you in. But I have to be me within that. You have to stay true to you. And I think the minute you lose that, your reflection of your own identity, I think that's when people lose their way and they just make bad decisions. They make the wrong decisions.
I completely agree. Authenticity is something people can feel. And when you're constantly trying to imitate somebody else, you do lose everything. You lose the very thing that could make you stand out. So Tommy, thank you again. It's fascinating hearing how identity culture and the expectations placed upon us can shape not only the choices we make, but also how comfortable we feel being completely ourselves. We're going to take another short break now for a word from our sponsors. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Belinda Walia and I'm joined today by the wonderful Tommy Sandu. Welcome back, Tommy.
Thank you. It is nice. It's nice to have this little chat. And you're very good as well. I want you to know this because what you do so well is, you know, I'm such a blibberer and I blibber out all this stuff. And as I'm talking to you now and I'm thinking back on it, I'm thinking, what am I even saying? You know, because
it makes sense. Don't worry.
But that's why it works on stage, because I can just blibber. Something happens and it just kicks in and I can just keep going and I can ramble and I can tangent and this. After I've blibbered, you go, that's really nice, Tommy, because you've reflected on this. And I'm like, oh, yeah, what she said. That's what I did, because you make it sound succinct and lovely. So thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. I don't know how you do that. Make sense of the madness.
Thank you for that, Tommy. Now, you've had such a strong connection with British Asian audiences. What changes have you witnessed within the community over the years?
Oh, good one. What changes? Okay, so, I think community is something that evolves. It always has done over the years of you know, all the years while man's been here, communities change, the role of people changes. Even when you look at from everyone from their genders and identities and things like that, that now that is a change. It's a change that people are struggling to deal with. Some are, you know, some are struggling to come out and say that they feel different, that they are different. So everything's evolving. What I genuinely love about Sikhi and Sikhism, my faith, is that it's a new religion. So I like the faith and what we stand for. And therefore, what I've noticed when I've been on air is that the older generation are a bit more connected to their roots and language and their mother tongues, and somehow are like morals and principles that go back to their kind of mother countries, you know, or their ancestral countries. And the newer generation aren't that. They are more established British. And, you know, I think my sons don't really feel that Bessie connection like I did. There's a little bit less in terms of reference points in their daily lives, whereas we were just grew up with, you know, the video cassettes were Silsila, Sholle, Amar Akbar Anthony, you know, Amit Bachchan. My sister's albums were Nazia Hassan alongside Wham. And we watched Grease alongside Jaws, alongside Michael J. Fox's Back to the Future or whatever, and then all the Bollywood stuff, particularly of the 80s and, you know, all of that. So I think that's kind of changing the sound of, you know, the kind of music, what they're making, what the messages they're saying at the different. And also, you've got to remember, a kid now who's 20, 22, 23, 24, 25 could be my kid. You know, I had kids later, but I mean, I'm going to be 50. I can easily have a 25, not a 30-year-old kid. So with someone like me as a dad, they're not going to be a typical, you know, follow the Asian rules. You know, and even I've said to my sons now, I said, look, fortunately, we do lots of work in property as well as, you know, the radio and TV and entertainment. And I've just launched my own spicy mayonnaise and we're developing flats and houses elsewhere. And there's so many things going on. I said, look, you're going to be in a very different spot to what I was, and I'm in a different spot to what your bubba was, my dad was, or his dad was when they came over to the country on a boat, literally. So things, I think, have to evolve. You move with the times. I think, in general, dare I say it, there is something important about being aware of your culture and history and where you've come from, like I said, generationally. But I also think it's quite important to move with those times, to kind of say, you know what, those things aren't relevant anymore. You know, where are you from isn't relevant. If you said to my son, Milo, where are you from? He'd just go East London. Like, well, I don't know what that question means. Mm-hmm. Maybe because of me being the slight weird dad that I am. And I talked to him about identity and, you know, their brownness. And I talked about what it means to be them in this world as well, and how the world is changing. And I said to him, I hope in the future that just everyone just gets over the pigmentation thing of skin color and just kind of accepts,
yes,
black, white, brown as just people. Because I think by then, hopefully, everyone will be from everywhere, and no one is brown because they're from India, or black because they're from there, and da, 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 white because they're from there. I remember going to Brazil and seeing that black, white, and brown people in Brazil were, yeah, Brazilian. They're all Brazilian, and they are seen as Brazilian. They see each other as Brazilian. I'm sure there's some nuanced racial stuff that still goes on in their cultures and communities, but it wasn't that, oh, a Brazilian person looks like that. There was literally, it was every shade of completely white to completely black and everything in between. And I was like, this is the future. This is how the world needs to be. That's it. You know, just accept that this pigmentation is irrelevant. Like, there are idiots in every culture, religion, whatever. And coming back to your question, though, I think the key thing is connections to the roots. That's changing. But also, you know, I like the new generation. I think they as much as people give the new generation like a hard time, they're all, they're lazy, they don't know how to work hard, they've got all these anxieties and issues. I think the ones that are smashing it are super smashing it, because they've got 5-year plans. They're using tech and AI to help shape business plans and their career plans. My nephews, nieces don't drink. They work out every day. You know, they're, I'm like, man, they're better people than I was. I was an idiot at 20 years old. They were, but they're a lot more focused. So I'd like to think that culture is changing like that. It's fusing a little bit more. And the British Asianness is just becoming Britishness, which is fine. I don't think people feel threatened by that. Oh, you're losing your roots. No, you should still be aware of your roots and your history. You can learn about that and be proud of what your ancestors went through. But where's your pride now? You can't coast. I can't coast off the fact that, oh, my ancestors were warriors, Sikhs, Jat Sikhs, the people, landowners, you know, they knew how to look after their land. I tell you now, Belinda, I can't even look after a basil plant. My basil plant dies within 3 days. So I don't know what kind of Jat I'd be if I was in India right now, just be killing all my crops. But let down Jat. But it's nice to feel that pride of the roots. But fact is now, you know, move with the times.
And each generation carries something forward, which is lovely, but yeah, they also have the freedom to create their own version of belonging, which I love that you've shared all of that. And finally, Tommy, if you could sit down with the younger version of yourself before any of this happened, what would you tell him about success, setbacks, and staying true to who you are?
I did this yesterday. Oh. No word of a lie. I went out for a walk yesterday evening. But, you know, I went to the gym and the adrenaline's still going. So you're like, let's just go walk it off. And I remember thinking, I just had this little sort of feeling of the future me talking to me yesterday. So you're taking it to another. And I remember saying, it's all fine. Everything's fine. Because sometimes you think, I've got to do this and I've got to do that. And like, I'm not being cocky here. I think I would say to my younger self that, you know, it all works out. Not that I really did worry too much. I think being the younger son, the only son and the youngest, you're mollycoddled. I know I'm blessed. I've had two older sisters that are like a couple of extra mums, right? So I've been loved, overly loved all my life. Super protected, super encouraged. And when you're encouraged and protected and loved and supported like that, it's important to be aware of it and be grateful for it, which I really am. But also you realize it gives you a kind of a bounce to keep going. If you keep criticizing, and I'm sometimes worried that I can be a bit harsh on my sons because I don't want idiot boys. I don't want boys because I think I had an awareness of girls and sisters in my life. I'm not that kind of ladsy lad. And I don't want to raise ladsy lads or basically kind of idiot boys that I meet out and about and think, oh God, like you have no idea on how to speak. I like to raise them to be articulate, to be sensitive, to be aware, to be manly, but also to be, you know, smart and savvy and emotionally in tune with whatever's going on around them. So I would say to myself, my younger self, just carry on as you are. Don't worry so much. I think I worried a lot about certain things because of build projects and things like that. But no, I even said it to myself yesterday, which is, hey, everything's fine. Everything is going to be fine. And everything that all, and you know, I keep hearing this line at the moment, which is the obstacle is the journey or the obstacle is the way, which basically means if you're going through the challenges, that means you're on the path. If there's no challenges, there is no path. You're nowhere. So every little challenge we face just means that we're on our way to wherever it is that we're trying to get to. But we'll save that for another podcast.
A wonderful note to end the show. Everything is fine. Tommy, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been such a pleasure getting to know more about the person behind the microphone. And what I love about today's conversation is that we've explored so much more than a successful career. We've talked about identity, culture, even masculinity when you mentioned your sons, setbacks and reinvention, how our definition of success can change as we move through life. So sometimes the chapters that don't go according to plan are the very ones that teach us the most about who we are. So Tommy, before we finish, where can our listeners connect with you, follow your comedy and keep up with what you're doing next?
I think it's mainly Instagram. I'm lazy. I find it so tiring to post. I'll put the hashtags in. Oh, that's got to be vertical. That's going to be horizontal. That's going to be literally. I'm like, oh, can someone do this for me, please? So, Instagram is probably the place. There's so much going on, and so please just keep an eye on Instagram, and see what the next little bit has to kind of offer. And I think I think there's some fun times ahead, actually.
Thank you for that, Tommy. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. And today's song choice is a part of the song Coldplay, Viva La Vida, a song that feels particularly fitting for a conversation about success, change, perspective, and the different chapters of life. Thank you for listening to the Healthy Debate Show here on UK Health Radio. I'm Belinda Walia, and until next time, take care of yourselves and each other. It was a wicked and wild wind, blew down the doors to let me in, shattered windows and the sound of drums, people couldn't believe.